for having me here. So what I'm going to talk about in the next hour or so is a lot of results that we have been accumulating by studying, again, as the title says, the structure of singularities of superconformal field theories. This work has been done with like a bunch of people, including Federico Bonetti, Carlo Meneghelli, Cody Long, and Leonardo Rastelli, but mostly, more and foremost, with Philip Argyris. So I'm going to be telling you a lot of stuff in many different contexts. Hopefully, basically the sense that I want to kind of communicate is that by carefully studying specifically the Coulomb branch of those theories, you can learn a whole lot that you would not even expect in the beginning. So I don't know how many people in this room need an introduction on why we even need to study superconformal field theories, but in case you need an introduction, that's, you know, the next three slides are for you. And I don't know if I will be able to convince you that that's a good thing to do, but hopefully you already know it. But so why? What is the spirit? Well, if you're interested in quantum field theory in general, then you can see conformal field theories as kind of the fundamental bricks of effective field theory, meaning like those are the fixed points, and then you can kind of span the whole spaces of possible quantum field theories by studying, learning about the fixed points, and then studying kind of RG flows among fixed points. So studying CFDs could actually also be useful to learn about specific effective field theories, actual theories of reality, of nature. But one of the reasons why, you know, we also put an S in front of it, so it means superconformal field theories, is that, you know, if you add supersymmetry to conformal invariants, you have many more tools at our disposal. I mean, there's lots of people in this room that are working on the subject. There's a bootstrap, there's string constructions, compactification of six-dimensional, five-dimensional theories, and specifically also everything that I'm basically going to tell you about relies heavily both on the existence of a conformal invariant and supersymmetry. By studying those theories, we already kind of learn a whole lot about field theories. For instance, dualities, the existence of non-Lagrangian theories, which I'm going to mention a little bit later. Those are all things that we have learned by studying superconformal field theory. So the hope is that we can learn a whole lot more, right? So whether or not you're interested in the mathematics of superconformal field theories, it's really a subject where we can grasp and gather a lot of information. So what is the goal of the talk? Once again, so I'll throw out names and then kind of going to be more pedagogical in following slides. So I will be kind of more systematic in the defining singularities and moduli space and everything. But this is kind of the gist. So supersymmetric theories in general have moduli space of vacua. In particular, n equal 2 supersymmetric theories have generically, or we believe, that any non-trivial n equal 2 theory has a Coulomb branch moduli space of vacua. And in those Coulomb branches, it's known since the work of Saber and Witten, have a singularity structure that actually encodes a lot of information about those theories. Right? Again, I will come back to those things and define it more systematically, but you have Coulomb branches of any of those theories, you have singularities, and what we want to do, we want to study those systematically and understanding the structure of those singularities. You will see that specifically if you ask that there is also conformal invariants, you can say a whole lot about them. And if you add the assumption that there is 8 or more supercharges, actually, the more it's even more restrictive, so n equal 3 or n equal 4 theory in 4 dimension, then you can see that you can really kind of almost fully specify the singularity structure of those Coulomb branches. The spirit of usually when you talk about Coulomb branches, you start with a theory, and you ask about that theory, what is the Coulomb branch, what is the moduli space of the theory? What we want to kind of do is the reverse. We want to try to extrapolate what are the geometric ingredients for a given variety to be interpreted as a Coulomb branch, as a moduli space of vacua of a theory, and use that evidence for saying, Okay, if there is a space that can be interpreted as a moduli space, or specifically a Coulomb branch, of an n equal 2 or higher SCFT, that's an evidence for the existence of those SCFTs. Okay, so we want to turn that around. That's the spirit of the talk. Hopefully that's somewhat clear. And as I'm going to tell you, the study of these singularities, the fact that we can systematically or almost systematically classify those spaces can tell us a lot about the existence of those theories in the spirit that I told you. And so it sets targets for actually explicitly constructing those theories. Once again, we want to try to study the possible varieties that can be interpreted as Coulomb branches or moduli space of n equal 2, 3, or 4 SCFTs. But that obviously, it's not a proof that the theory exists that has that particular variety as its Coulomb branch, right? But at least sets a target for other type of constructions that can somewhat more explicitly construct the theory that could prove that that Coulomb branch arises. And that has already been fruitful, so we've already been able to find explicit new n equal 2 theories, even in the simplest case, because we had this systematic analysis of the Coulomb branches. Is that clear? Okay.
So, sorry, can I ask a quick question? So, so when I have n equal 2 theories that come from isolated singularities, when I put brains at singularities, mm-hmm. in, say, F theory, they do not have a Coulomb branch?
They do, right?
So those theories have fixed coupling, right?
No, but the Coulomb, so these are two things, right?
There's well, I understand, but I'm just...
No. The majority, the overwhelming majority of theories that we're going to construct are isolated SCFTs.
Okay.
So that's I'm talking about the Coulomb branch. I'm not talking about the conformal manifold. And so the space of kind of marginal coupling, exactly marginal coupling.
But there are no examples, you're saying there are no known examples where there is 8 supercharges and no Coulomb branch.
There are no known examples, and I can tell you some evidences that you can interpret it as much, you know, how strong those evidence are, that couldn't be. I don't think there is any way to prove that statement, but that's what I believe. It's based on some arguments and evidences. Okay. It's far from being a proof, but it's not. Okay. Any more questions?
Is there a Coulomb branch operator in the stress tensor multiplier?
No. Right. So there could be. They could exist.
Well, there's three hybrids, right?
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's the whole point. Like the whole point is to have. To have a non-free theory, okay? Of course you can construct a theory that's free, that has no Coulomb branch.
Is there some operator theoretic reason why you believe Coulomb branch always exists?
Sorry?
Is there some reasoning based on local operators why you believe the Coulomb branch always exists?
No, I mean, that would be tantamount to a proof that the Coulomb branch couldn't exist. So basically the two evidences are, one is that there's a way to systematically build basically, there's almost a factory of n equal 2 SCFTs through compactifying 62.0 theories on different Riemann surfaces. And they've constructed about, you know, tens of thousands of theories. And they have a way to check that basically none of them has any factor that has no Coulomb branch. There's a way they can count the stress energy tensor of each one of those theories, so they can actually show that all the theories that they have. They don't see any theories that doesn't have a Coulomb branch, nor they come up as a factors of those theories. And then there's also other, but those type of evidences. So they're not fundamental kind of reasoning. It's just that there's been a lot of constructions. We have seen a lot of theories, and none of them appear to be rank zero. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. So that's the plan of the talk. Hopefully, we can go through all of this. So I'm going to be a little more systematic in introducing exactly the objects that we're going to study, what are the singularities and all of that. I'm going to be telling you how to still, you know, again, I'm going to set up things, hopefully a little bit more clear, but then I'll go back to all the notations I'm going to set up here and give some details on how things work in the simplest possible case, which is the rank one case where we claim to have been able to fully classify all possible theories that exist. And then you know, we'll jump up on the next hardest problem to tackle, which is the simplest problem to tackle, which is the rank two. And then hopefully we'll end by giving you the kind of a almost complete understanding assumption story if we, instead of like just going up in rank, we actually include higher supersymmetry. So we claim that we can classify all those singularity structures. Okay? So stop me at any time if things are unclear. So let me define exactly what are the objects that I'm going to be studying. So as I mentioned kind of already, what I want to study is the Coulomb branch of n equal 2 SCFTs. So in general, an n equal 2 theory, a gauge theory, has an n equal 2 vector multiplet, which can be written in terms of n equal 1 chiral multiplet and an n equal 1 vector multiplet. So it's basically one of the components of the vector multiplet is a scalar. And so this guy can obviously, in principle, acquire a VEV. And so the VEV, the space of VEVs of this guy, of this phi, is what I call the Coulomb branch. So to be, for instance, specific in one case, in the simplest case, let's say I have an SUN theory, then phi is in the same multiplet as the gauge boson, so it transforms under the adjoint of the gauge group. Again, we are moving, you know, through these things, we are moving off to non-Lagrangian theory. So this is just a way to understand, talking about gauge theories, but this generalizes far beyond that. So if we have an SUN gauge theory, then you can show that the space of vacua is parametrized by n complex parameters. So this phi can be diagonal. Any of those values kind of describe a vacuum. But then because this is an SUN matrix, it has to be traceless. So it's n complex dimensional plus one condition. So in total, it's n minus one complex dimensional. And n minus one is, in fact, exactly the rank of SUN. And once all these values of ans are different, then the theory is the SUN gauge group is broken to U1 to n minus 1, right? So the physics on the Coulomb branch is just a bunch of U1s. And in general, actually, if you're careful, the ans, the set of values, are not gauge invariant. There is further gauge identification. And so what really parameterizes the Coulomb branch aren't this n minus 1 complex dimensional quantity, but some polynomials of them. So the UI are the actual are functions of the A's and are the ones that really kind of parameterize the gauge invariant vacua. They take care of all gauge transformation. So from now on, this U1 to UR are the coordinates of this Coulomb branch that I'm talking about. So obviously, as I stated in the notation, I'm going to be thinking that the Coulomb branch is R complex dimensional. And as I told you before, in the Lagrangian case, you see explicitly in the SUN that the dimensionality of the Coulomb branch matches the rank of the gauge group. And so we take that as a definition of the rank of a theory. And we will use that as a definition of the rank of a non-Lagrangian theory where you don't obviously have any type of gauge group. So the dimensionality, the complex dimensionality of the Coulomb branch is what sets the rank of your theory. Okay? Now, one of the main insights by Sabat and Witten is that the space is actually not a manifold; it's singular at some points. Actually, more they're not points; they are complex codimension one variety, but it's singular places. And the values of these U's, where the Coulomb branch is singular, have a very specific physics interpretation. That is the places in the Coulomb branch where there is extra massless stuff that appears in the theory. Okay. I'll go back to that point. Furthermore, phi, which is the scalar component of the vector superfield, has a non-zero UNR charge. It's a singlet of SU2R symmetry, but has a non-zero charge under this UNR charge, which sets the scaling dimension of phi. In addition, we assume that our variety is scaling invariant, right? So there is a UNR action of phi, which is the guy that basically parameterizes the VEVs of the Coulomb branch. And furthermore, there is a scaling action just because, by assumption, the variety that you obtain is scaling invariant. So you can combine these two guys, and there is an action on your Coulomb branch, which is a C star action. Okay, this is important because we're going to use that C star action to actually understand what type of singularities can appear. I'll go back to that explicitly in rank one and show how those things work. But again, the important thing is that there is a CSR action on your Coulomb branch. You have an R complex dimensional variety. And how do we go about classifying everything that can appear? Okay? So again, roughly speaking, there are three steps that you have in your head. One is to talk about the topology or how those singularities can appear. The other one is the geometry. And the third point is the deformation. Can, what do I mean by that? The topology of the singularity is defined by the fact that, one, the singularity has to be complex codimension one, and two, in order for the singularity of this variety to be scale invariant, has a set, has to be closed on the C star action. I will go back to that, so in an explicit example, and just show how this is constraining. And for rank one and two, this is a very constraining condition that almost specify completely what type of singularities you can have in your space. Again, I will go back to it.
But in principle, there could be higher codimension singularities.
No, it can be lower codimension.
Well, I mean, lower.
It's not higher codimension. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yes, of course.
So these are part of your assumptions?
You know, of course, but it's part of the complex codimension one singularity, right? There's sub-varieties of lower codimension. Precisely.
Can there be codimension two singularities that don't lie on a codimension one singularity?
I don't think that's possible. Yeah. So the complex codimension, lower codimension, higher codimensions always appear as...
No, but if you just answered the question, so if that's the case, then there are singularities that you cannot access from codimension one.
No, they always appear as sub varieties of a complex codimension one singularity.
So which means that this is your assumption, or you can prove that that's always the case.
Okay, so that's a fair point. I'll have to think more deeply about it to see if I have an argument to show that they cannot be the case. But I am okay. Let's make an assumption.
In the Lagrangian cases, of course, that's
right. No, of course, that's of course. But we want to move up away from Lagrange. That's a good point. So, what I mean by geometry? Well, I'm going to again. I've been a little quick, but hopefully I can go back to it, and those things can make more sense. So, if you heard anything about Sabah-Witten. The guys that really play a big role in describing the geometries aren't the U's necessarily, the U's are the color, the parameters, the coordinates of the Coulomb branch, but are some holomorphic functions of those U's. Those holomorphic functions are called special coordinates, and is that are the objects which define your tau ij, your holomorphic gauge couplings of the R U1s that are left unbroken on the Coulomb branch. So on top of this topological variety, you have extra conditions, and the A and A dual define a metric, right, on your variety. And so those conditions are obvious from the Lagrangian point of view, but we're trying to extrapolate what are the conditions that we need to use to move away from that point. So the metric has to be basically non-degenerate and has to be symmetric. So the A and A dual should define a tau ij that is symmetric in I and j and has the imaginary positive imaginary part. And then there is one more thing that is very important to constrain what possible singularities you have, is the fact that once you loop around a singularity, if you take a loop on the Coulomb branch in the U coordinates and you go back to the same point, then the A and A dual, they don't have to go back to the exact same values, but they can go back to the same values up to an electromagnetic duality transformation, which for a theory of rank R is a matrix of SP to RZ. So remember, there's RA dual, and so they can go back on a closed loop up to a matrix that is an SP to RZ. Okay? So those are the set of geometric constraints that we would see that it's surprisingly rich, even though I'm telling you things that are if you're clever enough, then you can suck a lot of information. And then there is this idea of deformation, meaning that you already kind of know if you're familiar with the simplest example. So it's a since the first paper, or maybe the second paper, no, the first paper of Sabat and Witten, they realized that both the SU2 with four flavors, which is an n equal 2 theory, and the SU2 with one adjoint, which is an n equal 4 theory, both theories have the same Coulomb branch. You cannot tell them apart if you just look at their Coulomb branch in the scale invariant limit. The way you can tell them apart is if you turn on a mass for the adjoint and you turn a mass for the four flavors, the way in which the Coulomb branch is deformed is different. Okay? So there's a general idea that classifying the scale invariant geometries does not tell you everything you need to know about the existence of the theories, because there's many theories that share the same scale invariant geometry. Okay? So now again, doing the turning on the masses in the Lagrangian case is simple, but doing it in a non-Lagrangian case is much more complicated. And so in order to fully classify the possible theories that exist, you have to classify the possible singularities in the scale invariant limit and then understand what happens when you turn on masses. This is probably the most complicated part of the whole story. And we carried out the full classifications of rank one, but it's much more complicated in rank two. Okay? So again, those are the three steps: the topology, the geometry, and the deformation, and we try to like use them all. Any questions? Okay, so let's recap on rank one. There's a bunch of papers that we have written, but I'm going to give you a short survey of it. Again, the bottom line is that we believe that we have classified all rank one n equal to SCFTs. And again, rank one, basically, if you restricted yourself to Lagrangian theories, you only have an SU2 as a gauge group, not a Abelian gauge group. And so in this case, phi just gets the BEV like that, A minus A. And your scaling, your gauge invariant coordinate of your one complex dimensional Coulomb branch is just U, which is equal to A squared. Okay? So in this case, in the rank one, just means that we're dealing with a one complex dimensional Coulomb branch. That's simple. Again, let me review the exact same structures that I already told you, but this is more in concrete example. So this is rank one, so you have only one A and one A dual, so they form a two complex vector. And if I take, so this is my Coulomb branch, this is literally my Coulomb branch, it's two real dimensions, one complex dimensional. You can take a loop around, and if after this loop, A and A dual should go back up to an SL2Z transformation. SL2Z and SP2Z are the same thing. Okay, so A, B, C, and D are integers and the determinant one. So there is one thing I can show you, for instance, is that so only you can only have a non-trivial monodromy, only non-trivial matrix, if you encircle a singularity. That's a very simple argument. Remember, I just told you that this matrix that I pick up around gamma has to be a matrix with value in the integer. Assume that that encircles no singularity, then one thing you can do is to shrink that curve to nothing. And the matrix that you pick up along that curve as you're shrinking it to nothing has to continuously vary as you're shrinking it. But because A, B, C, and D can only get only value in the integers, there's obviously no continuous deformation that you can get, right? So the idea is that if you continuously shrink a curve, you don't change the monodromy. But of course, if you can shrink the loop to nothing, then you should be able to shrink your initial monodromy to the identity. So we come to the conclusion that if you can shrink the curve to nothing, then the monodromy must be the identity. If you have non-trivial monodromy, it's because you cannot possibly shrink. There's something that prevents the loop to be shrunk to zero. And that's exactly those singularities that I told you about, which, as I said, appears as value of the U parameter where you have extra massless state in the theory. And the monodromy, the matrix M, actually tells you about something about the physics of what becomes massless at those points. Okay? So let me now try to use the information that I told you about. There is a sysr action, right? What is there is in rank one, it's very simple. There's only one possible set that is invariant, which is not the whole Coulomb branch, that is invariant under the sysr action, and is basically the origin. Right? That's the only set that is invariant under the sysr action. So you immediately get that by requiring that the set of singularities is closed under the sysr action, you already get the singularity structure topologically of rank one, which is one point at the origin. Okay? Another way of seeing it, there's another way that is very intuitive to see it. Let's say you have two singularities on your Coulomb branch. Then the distance between the two singularities, it's a scale in the theory. And you're assuming that the theory is scale invariant. So scale invariant, n equal to rank one theories, can only have one singularity at the origin. Okay? So the most wild, and again, we are going as wild as we can, but the most wild geometries that you get in rank one is just a cone with some deficit angle. Questions?
Why can't it be a bunch of cones glued at the point?
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. But like, so it can be. And in fact, so that is the assumption that the Coulomb branch color ring is freely generated. So you can construct geometries like you said, and we did construct them. But we were hoping to construct those and find something wrong with it, because those implies that there is some relationship between the Coulomb branch operator, and we find no contradiction. But there is a conjecture that n equal to SFTs, for n equal to SFTs, the Coulomb branch chiral ring is freely generated. If you assume that, then we can discard that possibility. But you're completely right. You can construct theories with a bunch of cones that are only touching at the origin, but many people would consider it wild. But I don't think there's nothing that we could point out that was wrong with it. But I'm assuming that the Coulomb branch curving is freely generated. Thanks. So the special Kähler conditions where you adjust the fact that the tau is obviously symmetric, is one dimension, so there's no indices. And the fact the imaginary part of tau equal greater than zero sets no constraints, so those are trivially satisfying rank one. And the fact that you're taking a loop around a singularity, the fact that you have to pick a SF to Z matrix restricts the sets of possible scaling dimension or opening angles of your cone to this set of seven values. It's a relatively straightforward argument, which if you're interested, I can convince you about in like maybe 10 minutes, but I don't have the time right here. So again, from the topology, you concluded that it was a cone with an arbitrary deficit angle. By imposing the electromagnetic duality constraints, then you come up with just seven possibilities. This is the famous Kodaira classification that appears in many different contexts. And those are the names that Kodaira gave, and those are the scaling dimensions that we found. Dimension 6, 4, 3, 2, 3 half, 4 thirds, 6 fifth. These last three are known as Argyris-Douglas theories. The I0 star, this guy, has scaling dimension 2, as those are the Lagrangian theories. And these three are the E8, E7, E6, Minahan, and Manchensky, and many others. Okay? So you can derive these things just by this set of steps. There's many other ways you can derive the Kähler classifications, but this is one of the ways. So what happens now in mass deformation? I told you that this is the complete list of scaling invariant geometries. Now we have to understand. I told you that many theories could have the same scaling invariant limit, right? So we want to learn more about it.
Can you go back one slide? So over here you are using u coordinate. Are you all assuming that u equals a squared, basically?
No.
Okay.
Not at all.
Okay.
No. I'm assuming that a of u has scaling because the spatial coordinates appear in the central charge. You know the mass dimension of a and a dual. No matter how wild of a function they are, you know how to transform on the scaling. So that's what I'm using.
My only concern.
No.
Normally you have instanton corrections, right? So you can have a simple scaling relations and then.
But so we're not assuming any physics in some sense. The only assumption that I'm making, I mean, it's not an assumption, it's a fact that A and A dual, because they appear in the central charge, they have one scaling dimension one. So there is a scaling action, this sister action, that is globally defined on that's the assumption. You have a scaling invariant variety, so it has a globally defined scaling invariant action. And you know how that acts on you by picking up the scaling dimension of u, which you leave it as a free parameter, like you don't touch it. And you know how it acts on A, because it has scaling dimension one. And you just like patch those things together. You're not assuming, not computing anything from first principle in terms of physics.
Okay.
So what happens in mass deformation? Well, you can convince yourself, and I'm not going to do it, but that in, at least in a Lagrangian setup, if you turn on a mass for your hypermultiplet, what happens is that basically the place where the hypermultiplets become massless is no longer the origin, but it's somewhere off of the Coulomb branch. And so basically your initial singularity splits in a bunch of other singularities. So the genetic thing that happens in rank one is that once you turn on masses, your singularity splits, right? Splits in a bunch of other singularities. Basically the distances now is no longer scale invariant because you have more than one singularity, but you don't care because you have explicitly broken scale invariance by turning on a mass. And the distances between the singularities is basically proportional to the masses that you turn on. So everything is consistent. And so then we, one of the major problems for the rank one wasn't, again, deriving the Corrado classification, that's easy, but to come up with a set of constraints on classifying all possible splitting from first principle. Again, we're not assuming anything. We're just trying to understand what splitting can be consistent. I have no time to go through this because it's a lot of work. But this is a table that we wrote, and we discovered 10 new n equal 2 SCFTs, right? Which I think is pretty remarkable given that there's been a lot of people that worked on rank one for a long time. They're much smarter than me for sure. And so the advantage of this construction is that, again, you are being systematic. Right. The disadvantage is that you basically things get much more complicated already in rank two. But at least in rank one, where you can carry out the whole construction, you are systematic, and so you're sure that you're not missing anything.
Sorry, but you're basically discovering the infrared behavior of the series. Do you know what you're?
Yeah. Do you? Of course, we're studying the infrared behavior, but we know a lot about the U. I'm talking about the UV. So the point is that you can we have a formula to compute first the central charge, the A and C central charge of the UV theory, of course, by looking at the infrared behavior. There's a surprisingly, I mean, that's the point I'm trying to make. I'm telling you the 10 new n equal to SCFTs in UV. So we can say the flavor group, we can say scaling dimension, we can say the central charges, and some of them actually have been found. So, yeah.
So how do we get this?
I'm not going to tell you because I'm moving on rank two, but I can tell you I'm here tomorrow as well, and I can tell. It's a talk on its own. It's a set of constraints. Basically, the bottom line is look as usual, looking at the Lagrangian case, and trying to come up what are the conditions for a given splitting to be consistent, and then systematically go through all those consistent conditions. There's a bunch of conditions that are. They're physically sound, but that required like a talk on its own. Okay. So most of theories are non-Lagrangian. And many actually at the moment don't even have an S-class description at them. Okay? We also found, and you know, with Ben we're discussing whether or not these things are consistent, but we also found a geometry that seems to suggest that there is a different n equal 4 theory that has the full SL2Z as duality group. But we're still trying to settle that up.
Can you, for those of who do not know, what's S class description? I don't know.
Okay. So this is basically whether or not can this, by that I define that you can obtain this theory as a reduction of an S6D theory on a Riemann surface.
Okay.
Basically. Yeah. So how did that generalize to rank two? I'm going to repeat the same steps. Things are, you know, you can already sense that it gets a little wilder. So rank two, again, means that the complex dimension of the Coulomb branch is two. And the dimension of this thing, you could call it nu, uv, whatever you like. It's the singularity. So the singularity is one complex dimension. So the singularity itself is two real dimensions, right? So things already get a little more complicated because you can't visualize stuff. We had points and now you have things that are surfaces. And I change notation. Instead of calling U1 and U2, I call it U and V. And the scaling action, this is a C star action, right? Acts on them that way. And where delta U and delta V is it's a scaling dimension of your Coulomb branch phenomenon. Okay? That's just your C star action. And there is an argument you can show that because he wants the, so there is an argument that you can make to restrict how well those singularities should behave, and is the basically the assumption is that those values have to be rational. And so I'm going to write delta U and delta V in this way, as R, where R is an arbitrary rational number, and P and Q, so and it's a common factor between the two, and P and Q have greater common divisor 1. I can always do that. Okay? Now there is 3 possible sets already topologically of things that are invariant, that are closed under scaling action. You can check that obviously U equals 0 is closed, V equals 0, and then there is U to the P over V to the Q. Maybe it's U to the Q over V to the P, one of the two. But in such a way, if delta U and delta V are written that way, basically there is a ratio of some powers of U and V such that the lambdas cancel, right? So it's preserved by the scaling action. Make sense? So already, you know, as I told you, in rank 1, you only had 1 possibility, which was a single point. In rank 2, you already have a much more complex thing. So what does the singularity look like? In order to help, I don't know how much this next 2 slides will help you visualizing it, but so again, this guy is a surface embedded in C4, in C2, in R4, right? So it's very hard to visualize. So one thing you can do, you can take V and intersect V with a 3 sphere with a given radius. The reason why it's a smart thing to do is because the radius of the 3 sphere is basically takes away the kind of a contractible direction, which is the scaling direction. So it's the real scaling direction. You can kind of scale the radius up and down, but by assumption, the singularity doesn't change under scaling. So by taking the intersection of the singularity with its 3 sphere with a given radius, you're kind of taking away 1 trivial directions. You're not losing any topology. And so you're restricting your 2 real dimension singularity to a 1 real dimension singularity. So I'm taking a given parameterization of the 3 sphere like that. If you do all the steps, you see that, for instance, if you take the U equals 0 singularity intersected with a 3 sphere, it just gives you basically in the V plane, it gives you 1 loop in the V plane, right? So the singularity with the intersected with the 3 sphere is just a circle in the V plane at U equals 0. Okay? If you take the singularity for V equals 0 as a circle in the U plane with V equals 0. Okay? What if you do this guy? Well, I'm kind of going to skip those steps because I don't know to what extent they're incredibly useful, but you can believe me that what you get is that this is the generic structure of the singularities, meaning that the intersection of your 2 real dimension thing, singularity with the 3 sphere, is a PQ, where P and Q are those relative prime numbers that appear in the scaling dimensions of U and V, torus linked. That means it's a 1-dimensional thing that wraps around the torus, P times in 1 directions and Q times in another direction. And the fact that it's a link is because you can have n parallel component of those. And the U equals 0, V equals 0 guys are basically unknowns. Means that are single loops that even go inside the torus or outside the torus. Okay, again, if you are interested in understanding this carefully, we can go through it. It's simple, but the bottom line is not just the specific geometry. You already see that you have gone from a point in rank 1 to a much more complicated. So in rank 1, again, topologically, there is only 1 possible singularity. There is a single point. In rank 2, you already see that there is, you know, depending on P and Q, you have different knots, and then you can have multiple components of those. You can have things inside the torus, outside the torus. So things are really becoming much more complicated topologically.
Sorry, maybe you just answered my question. On the previous slide, can you go 1 slide back? So when you say P theta equals Q phi, right? So of course, you know.
That's
why I was
That's the tallest link, yeah. That's a torus knot, yeah.
No, that's not what I mean, when I teach complex variable, I teach about multi-branches, multiple branches, right? So over here, there can be plus whatever, 2 pi. So wouldn't that be kind of the structure that you excluded before, like sort of things joining in?
Yeah, sure.
So but how come it's allowed? Okay.
No, but I'm not here. I'm not considering a branching. I'm not considering the possibility of having anything branched over. No,
but this relation, I think the relations that you're saying, P to the Q over V, U to the P over V to the Q equals 1, right? So that gives you multi-branched relations between P and Q, between U and V.
But yeah, so this... But this
it's not just simple P theta equals Q phi.
You're only choosing one branch.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, I agree. But yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, but the point is that, so this the relationship is not, it's you know, I'm taking a sub-variety of CE2, right? I'm not trying to, so U and V don't satisfy any relationship in some sense. As, do you see what I'm saying? As operators. Those are just, I'm just like, I'm asking, I have C2, and what is the sub-variety of C2 that is, what is the values of in C2 that satisfy this equation? Because I'm already assuming that topologically, the whole thing is C2. I think you it would be true if I assumed that you had two Coulomb branch operators that satisfy a non-trivial relationship, and I'm asking where can those valves take value, right? But I'm assuming already that the values are in C2. And so then this is just a subset, a sub-variety of C2 that satisfies. Does it make sense? We can talk.
Yeah, I just cannot think fast enough. Okay,
so one thing that, for instance, is remarkable, and I think is really remarkable, is that by using special Keeler conditions, so again, I'm not going to show you anything because I'm going to be here, so I can explain to you all those statements in details. But you just I just want to kind of give you a taste on the extent that we can learn about those theories, but just relatively simple considerations. So if you put together special Keeler conditions, right, which again means that the metric is not degenerate and the tower J is symmetric, and the fact that the monodromies that you get, you know, again, you have those like complicated singularities. If you take a loop around any of those strands, then the A and A dual should transform under some matrix of SP4Z, right? And the whole thing has to be tied together with the fact that it has to be the C star action globally defined. And you know more or less the quantities of your game, how they have to transform under the scaling action. If you tie everything together, you can actually, and you're kind of clever in what loops you take, then you can learn a whole lot about the analytic behavior of A and A dual. Again, from first principle, how A and A dual had to depend on the U and V parameter. And if you assume no unknots, meaning that there is no guy inside the torus, you can go as wild as you want in terms of like having any number of components of any P and Q, then you can show that U and V can only take one of these 24 values. Remember, you know, in rank one, you had 7 values in the quadratic classification, and we claim that there exists no rank two theory that has no unknots, and we believe that maybe this is actually we don't know how to generalize it in the case of presence of the unknots, but it's not that cannot be done. That does not have this guy.
So are these numbers U over V or something?
Huh? No, it's
U
and V. U and V. The pair, no. It's actually these further constraints. There's further constraints on the fact that not all pairs can appear, but that's... So the bottom line is that you can actually constrain, from first principles, the possible scaling dimension. And we believe that argument can be actually generalized to any rank. And we can actually compute those values. I mean, I don't know if we can compute them if the rank goes high enough. But it's linked to basically the fact that this incredibly constraining structure of the fact that the special coordinates have to transform under this SP4 SP2RZ matrices, and everything has to be tied together in such a way to give like a scaling invariant geometry. So I think that's one very remarkable result.
So is U and V having the rational scaling dimension an assumption or a proven fact?
For the moment, an assumption. I mean, this is not really you can show that the singularities has like a semi-problematic behavior, but I don't think you can really prove that that behavior is unphysical. It sounds unphysical, but it's not really unphysical. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So let me just give you an example in details to get a sense of what the hell those like knots are, and they're actually much less. Weird stuff than you might think. So what is the simplest n equal 2 theory that you can think of is the SU3 n equal 4 theory, right? So for SU3, the phi actually takes the space of IQ is just A parameterized by A, B, and C, such that the sum of those guys is zero. And the invariant coordinates for SU3, the U and V that I talked about, are symmetric polynomials of the A, B, and C. Okay? So because phi is scaling dimension 1, U is going to be is quadratic in those A and B and C's, so it's scaling dimension 2, and V is scaling dimension 3. Right? So now, what are the singularities? Is it Lagrangian theory, so we can answer that question from first principle? So consider first SU3 with one adjoint. So you have one hypermultiple in the adjoint representation, that's an actual n equal 4 theory. So the singularity extra massless states only appear when there is an extra unbroken SU2, right? On a generic point of the Coulomb branch, SU3 is broken all the way to U1 to the square. But if there is any locus on the Coulomb branch where there is an unbroken SU2, then there is extra massless states, the W boson associated with SU2, right? And so then you can parameterize. So in terms of phi, that the locus is very simple to write down. It's just AA. I think it's minus 2a, obviously. That has to be traceless, right? That's a generic parameterization of the loci. But if you write that in terms of the Coulomb branch invariant coordinates, that this guy, the place where there is two of the a's are equal, is precisely where u cubed is equal to v squared. It's probably there is a factor of something, but you can obviously redefine your u such that the factor is 1. And so you get exactly the knot, right? You get basically u cubed over v squared equal to 1. That's the knot that I was telling you about. And appears very clearly in terms of a Lagrangian theory. So you would conclude that the n equal 4 theory has a single 3-2 knot. As a singular. The intersection, I mean, we're talking always, the knot is obtained by intersecting this guy with a 3-sphere. But it's basically the guy that I was describing before. What about the SU3 theory with 6 flavors? Things get more interesting, okay? So one very simple thing is that obviously when any of the A's, A, B, and C is 0, right? There is here now in the SU3 with 6 flavors, you have quarks transforming under, I mean quarks, hypermultiply transforming under the fundamental. So if any of the A, B, or C is 0, then those guys are massless, right? And that appears exactly where V equals 0. Right? V is A times B times C. So if any of the three vanishes, V vanishes. Okay? Okay? So you get, this is going to give you an N knot once you intersect with the 3-sphere. But this is, of course, there is still the locus where there is an unbroken SU2, right? That it's still a place where you have extra massless states coming from the W bosons. But so you would conclude that the SU3 with 6 flavors has an unknot for V equals 0 and a 3-2 knot coming from the unbroken SU2, the exact same things that we had before. But actually, this is a very interesting thing. What about non-perturbative effect, right? What do you mean by that? So what is the theory? What is the theory looking like? Let's say I'm in a locus on the Coulomb branch where phi assumes this bed, right? And I'm talking about SU3 with six flavors. Whenever I get to the scale A, right, SU3 breaks up to SU2 cross U1, right? But because all the A's are non-zero, all the hypermultiplet are massive, right? So the theory on this locus, the theory in the IR when the SU3 is broken to SU2 cross U1, if you have six fundamentals, is actually a pure SU2 theory with a U1, a factor. Right? There is no hypermultiplet. All the hypermultiplet are massless. So, and we know that the pure SU2 actually has non-perturbative effect, and the pure SU2 splits the single ion in the subway and further to a dion and a monopole, right? So that effect, actually, the fact that the SU2, the pure SU2, has a dion and a monopole, makes sure that your single 2-3-knot splits into a 2-3-2 link. So two components are parallel to each other. I don't know how pedagogical that was, but I'm saying that you can understand the existence of everything, of unknots, of the existence of knots, and the fact that you have multiple parallel components by just starting SU3 with one adjoint and SU3 with six flavors. Those things appear already there. Okay? So it's not very exotic. And let me make another observation, which is that the Coulomb branch singularity of the n equal 4 theory, which is is C2 with just a 2-3 knot, is in fact can be obtained as an orbifold fold of C2 over S3. That's what you obtain. The orbifold of C2 over S3 just gives you C2 with the 2-3 torus knot singularity that I just described. On the other side, the n equal 2 Coulomb branch, the one, the SU3 for six flavors that has these extra structures, the two links and the unknot, it's not an orbifold. Okay? That's an important statement for the last part of the talk in the last probably 5 or 6 minutes, which is, so I'm giving you, hopefully, so far, I'm giving you a perception that you can really, maybe things are a little bit complicated, but you can really kind of like, you know, extrapolate a lot of information in any ranks by studying carefully the monodromies and how things patch up together, right? What if now we assume that there is higher supersymmetry? So far, I just assume n equal 2, and I want to convince you that if I assume n equal 3 and n equal 4, then I can just tell you the singularity structure of all possible Coulomb branch geometries that can appear. Okay? So it's three more slides. So there's a statement that if you have 9 or more supercharge, then the moduli space M is flat. Remember, the moduli space is a metric that I wrote to you a long time ago in terms of the special coordinates, and that metric is flat. Now, there's a very non-trivial thing that we aren't able to prove, but if you can prove that any such moduli space can be written as orbifolds. Okay, that's a huge assumption, but it seems to be something that people are convinced about. And at least I showed you that the n equal 4 case, you can't, in the rank 2, you can write it as an orbifold. So if you can assume that any moduli space of vacuum of this n equal 3 and n equal 4 theories, because they are flat, they can be written as some c to the 3r over a discrete group, then we are basically we can solve the whole thing. And so the way we solve the whole thing is the fact that, again, the moduli space of vacuum of n equal 3 and n equal 4 theories is actually not just a Coulomb branch, but it's an extended Coulomb branch, meaning that it's much larger. And in fact, n equal 2 theories, again, a theory of rank R has an R complex dimensional Coulomb branch. Whereas for n equal 3 and n equal 4 theories, that generalizes to a 3R complex dimension. Got it. Right? But then, even though you're dealing with a much larger moduli space, there's always a component of that moduli space that is and can be interpreted as n equal 2 Coulomb branch. That's just a statement that n equal 3 and n equal 4 theory, it's also an n equal 2 theory. So everything that applies for Coulomb branches in n equal 2 has to apply from some subvariety of the larger moduli space of n equal 3 and n equal 4 theory. So if you assume that the n equal 2 Coulomb branch slice of the larger n equal 3 and n equal 4 moduli space the Coulomb branch slice is freely generated, that restricts gamma to be any discrete group, which is also a complex reflection group. And the claim is that using flatness, which basically relates A and A dual to a specific, the Coulomb branch coordinates, the Z and Z prime, flatness and the fact that the monodromy matrix has to appear in S before Z restricts gamma to be crystallographic, which means preserves the lattice, okay? So basically, all possible singularities have this structure, C to the 3R over some discrete group, which using basically n equal 2 constraints has to be a complex reflection crystallographic discrete group.
Sir, could you briefly remind me why it has to be SP for Z? No, it doesn't depend on the...
Sorry, SP 2RZ.
Oh,
2RZ. Sorry, that's the time. SP 2RZ. Right. But really what is important is that you go around the singularities and those things have to come back up to integers. So crystallographic complex reflection groups have been fully classified. And there's actually, so we can come up with the full list of singularities for n equal 3 and n equal 4 geometries. So that if you go through the list of each one of those groups, even at rank 2, there is new geometries, new n equal 3 geometries that have not been found. The reason why I'm not talking more about it, one is because it's over, and two, because like we are still working on the physical properties of it. So let me conclude now. And so really the bottom line is that the singularity structure of moduli space can tell you a whole lot about what possible theories can exist. And again, I want to stress again that it's a systematic, we're trying to do a systematic analysis rather than a constructive one, right? So we want to try to see from the simplest case up to try to not miss any cases. And definitely we've been pleasantly surprised that the attempt of classifying n equal 2 Coulomb branches seems to be extensible to higher ranks, even though, you know, we had to come up with new ideas, but it seems to be able to come up with new ideas that work all the time, and so that we can push things further. If you assume n equal 3 and n equal 4, then we seem to have a full answer for all ranks. Again, there is some assumption in there, and I try to be explicit in our assumptions, but those assumptions are relatively reasonable. At least everybody kind of would agree on them. And really, the one thing that I haven't talked about is that everything besides the rank one, it's only about the scale invariant limit. So what happens if I turn on masses? That's a much more complicated thing. That was basically where most of our work went in the rank one case. So it's probably even harder in rank two and higher. Thank you.
Oh, okay. So from this classification point of view, what's the difference between n equals 3 and n equals 4?
One thing that is very different is that you can kind of prove, that if you try to write down a theory with an exactly marginal operator that has n equal 3 supersymmetry, that theory also has n equal 4 supersymmetry. So in other words, if you want to write down a theory that has n equal 3 and not n equal 4, then that has to be an isolated SCFT. So the main difference is the existence of an exactly marginal operator. Vice versa, you can't, you know, any n equal 4 theory has to have an exactly marginal operator.
you claim that these geometries capture as safe disk, then you should be able to give me some more data. For instance, you should be able to give me the BP spectrum on a generic point of Coulomb branch. So how do that proposal?
So I don't think that that's necessarily true, in the sense that the full spectrum is a different story. I mean, I can definitely, I think I agree with you that I should be able to give you some information about the BPS spectrum, right? But already, for instance, in the rank one case, that is something that we understand very well. The way in which you can access the BPS spectrum is by turning on the masses. Once you split the singularity fully, then you know about it. But otherwise, if you just encircle the initial singularity, that gives you some information about what the BPS spectrum of the theory is. But unfortunately, it does not specify it uniquely. And it's basically, it's linked to the monodromy of around the singularity. That's what gives you the...
If I understand the massive deformations, I can reconstruct the BPS spectrum at m equals zero?
Yeah, yes, I think that's, I mean, I will have to probably think more carefully to like really say yes, but definitely. If you split the singularity fully, then you basically have a bunch of singularities, and then once you encircle each one of those singularities, then the monodromy tells you basically a lot of information about each one of those guys, and then you can take the inverse limit and use homomorphicity to say that those states should be in the theory, even in the scaling variant. But definitely, so, and that is in the rank one case where I actually understand it. So in rank two, I don't know really, but definitely I'm not expecting that anything that is not happening in rank one would happen in rank two. That's definitely not something we expect. So the fact, we're definitely not thinking that the understanding the scaling invariant limit is nearly enough to specify the theories at all. You have to look at the mass deform case. You have to.
So this wild guess, but do you think it can have some relation to knot theory because you have torus knots? So suppose you start from some theory, you have a torus knot, and computing some quantity in the UV theory can give some knot invariance associated to that torus knot. Do you think that can happen?
So I don't have real smart answer, but like the torus knot really. Here, the singularity is not a torus knot, right? It's the intersection with this three sphere that gives you a torus knot.
Right, so, right. Yes, that's boring.
Yeah. So the torus knot does not really appear in the theory at all, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know if this is my
answer. Yeah, sure.
But definitely, so I would be surprised. But I don't think, by that I mean that there is nothing fundamental with these appearances of torus knots. Because it's actually, I don't know how to visualize it because I don't know, I don't have an imagination to visualize 4D stuff. So I don't think there's anything fundamental. And I already showed you that this torus knot is simply like, can be interpreted as loci where there is a factor, the gauge group is not fully broken. Of course, that's only Lagrangian interpretation because for non-Lagrangian theories, that means nothing. But,
all right, we'll have an informal dinner with the speaker tonight, so let me know if you're interested, and thank the speaker again.